Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulippe. This week I'll be talking with conductor Bob Geary about the San Francisco Choral Society's production of the rarely heard King David by Arthur Onager this weekend. I've been tapped to be narrator for that piece, and I cornered Maestro Geary for a brief talk after our last rehearsal. Jesse Moss, director of the documentary The Bandit, will discuss his film, which closes the San Francisco International Film Festival on May 5th. Earlier this week, I also went backstage for a talk with conductor Pablo Heras Casado at Davie Symphony Hall. He's guest conducting the San Francisco Symphony this and next week. And we'll start today's show with a talk with actor Benjamin Scheuer to discuss his one-man coming-of-age show, The Lion, which just opened at ACT's Strand Theater. I hope you can stay with us this hour. Oh, and by the way, I'll offer some tickets to a couple of these events. So stay tuned. Benjamin, welcome to Open Air.
I'm very glad to be here in San Francisco.
I understand this piece had its gestation period at the Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut, which has birthed such hits as Annie, Man of La Mancha, Shenandoah. How did you end up at Goodspeed?
The Goodspeed Theater hosted a writer's retreat in conjunction with the Johnny Mercer Foundation. And the Johnny Mercer Foundation is a great organization, particularly for young songwriters. Songwriters between 18 and 30, check this out, guys. They're hosted at a one-week retreat at Northwestern University in the summer, and 15 young writers go out there and they study with three master teachers to work on songwriting, pop writing, musical theater writing, whatever. And I was out there in 2010. One of my teachers was Andrew Lippa, a wonderful Broadway songwriter. And anyway, the Mercer Foundation decided they wanted to expand, not only work with young songwriters, but also work with professional songwriters. And so the Mercer Foundation teamed up with the Goodspeed Theater, Goodspeed Opera House in Connecticut, and decided to host a month-long professional writers retreat. Now, because I'd gone to the one at Northwestern, they called me and they said, Benjamin, we're hosting a retreat for musical theater writers. Are you working on a show? Now, tell you the truth, man, I was not working on a show at all. I was playing coffee shop gigs around New York City and trying to make the dialogue between the songs better. But I was happy to take their money. And so I just lied to them, and I said, yeah, sure, I'm working on a show. And I went out to the Goodspeed Theater in January 2013, and I met Sean Daniels, who's a well-known theater director. And he said, you know, Benjamin, I really like what you're doing. I want to help you build this into a real evening, a theater. And so Sean and I worked on the show together. We went up to Vermont to the Weston Playhouse Theater in April 2013. And under Sean's guidance, I wrote a bunch of new songs and outlined the show, and including the song called Cookie Tin Banjo, for which there's a music video. That's the first song on the record, Songs from the Lion, which comes out the 1st of June. Actually, pre-release is this coming Friday. Right, so you can order it on iTunes on Friday, and you'll get the song Weather the Storm. You'll also get a song called Loving You Will Be Easy. Anyway, Sean and I went to the after the Weston Playhouse in April 2013, we went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is the biggest theater festival in the world, yeah. 2,500 shows. And we did our dress rehearsal, and Sean said, hey, Ben, I got a big note for you. Before we open tomorrow, you're actually missing a song. I can't believe we missed this, but you got to sing a song from the perspective of your dad, and he's got to bestow some wisdom. And so I stayed up all night and wrote a song from the perspective of dad bestowing wisdom. And we put it into the show the next day, and it's called Weather the Storm. Gather round, children, come here to my side. Sit by the fire where it's warm. I'll tell you something was once told to me about the way that we weather the storm. It's not how long the rain falls, or how hard the wind blows, or how deep is the snow in the road, nor the balance we fake when we feel the ground shake and we think that our world will explode. It's the help that we give, it's the love that we live, it's our pride in the friendships we form.
It's the courage we show facing things we don't know. It's the way that we weather the storm. If you try to stand tall, but you slip and you fall, in the earth is the sound of the stars. Truth gets revealed when you're broken and healed. Every heart is made stronger by scars. It's not how long the rain falls, or how hard the wind blows, or how deep is the snow in the road, nor the balance we fake when we feel the ground shake and we think that our world will explode. It's the help that we give, it's the love that we live, it's our pride in the friendships we form. It's the courage we show facing things we don't know. It's the way that we weather the storm. So go on your journeys, be bold and be brave. Be lions, my boys, and be strong. And when it is such that it all feels too much, then remember the words to this song. It's not how long the rain falls, or how hard the wind blows, or how deep is the snow in the road, nor the balance we fake when we feel the ground shake and we think that our world will explode. It's the help that we give, it's the love that we live, it's our pride in the friendships we form. It's the courage we show facing things we don't know. It's the way that we weather the storm. It's the way that we weather the storm.
Wow, beautiful. Writing, singing, playing, a triple threat I'm talking with here. Benjamin Scheuer, his show The Lion is at the Strand. ACT, beautiful, really beautiful.
Thank you. Conveniently, I don't have to dance in the show. I just sit in a chair. So,
well, we need to talk about some of those lyrics and weathering the storm, as this show is a very, very personal journey for you.
It's a true story. It's a story about my father, my relationship with my father. He taught me to play the guitar when I was a little boy. And he died suddenly when I was 13, right after we'd gotten into a fight and before we had managed to resolve it. I'm sure had he lived another 48 hours, we would have had a conversation and it would have been lost to the unimportance of the past. But alas, that is not what happened. And so my mother, who's British, moved our family back to London, where she lives, or where she grew up, rather. And I was a frustrated and guilty young teenager. I felt responsible for the death of my father. And I moved back to New York after a couple of years at an all-boys boarding school in the middle of nowhere in England, and started playing rock and roll, and met a girl at Grand Central Station, and all was going well. I was a rocker and had purple hair and a pierced belly button. Really, you can't see it now, but I'm dressed in a nice suit. I look like a grown-up.
Purple tie, but I don't know purple, about the belly button.
Purple tie, there you go. You can't see my belly, but who knows? You know, come see the show. Buy me a drink afterwards. So I moved back to New York, met a girl, and I started going great until she decided to go on a trip around the world without me, and eventually left me for a lesbian in Argentina who she shacked up with. And there I was at home feeling pretty lonely and pretty sad in New York. And I started losing weight, started sweating through my sheets at night. And the left side of my lower back hurt when I drank alcohol. And I just ignored all these things until I slipped and fell in Grand Central Station. When I went to my doctor, he told me that I had holes in my bones, and the reason I had holes in my bones was because I had advanced stage cancer, and I was 28 years old. And I couldn't believe it. It was a very strange thing to hear. And I did 6 months of chemotherapy successfully. I had a kind of cancer called Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I wrote about it the whole time. And I was also photographed once a week while I was ill. And this was interesting. My cancer doctor, my oncologist, said to me, he said, "Ben, listen, when you get chemotherapy, you're going to get better on the inside, but you're going to look worse on the outside." And I thought this was a fascinating visual contradiction and ripe for the creation of visual art. So I called my friend Raya Lerner, and Raya photographed me once a week, and we put together a book of these photographic images next to the text that I kept from the journals while I was ill. And it's a book called Between Two Spaces. And Between Two Spaces is to raise money for the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. It's a project about which I'm really proud. It can be found in the lobby of all the shows where I'm touring the Lion. It can also be found at betweentwospaces.com.
And I imagine at thelionmusical.com, some links to that as well. Now, stage four Hodgkin's lymphoma, that's some pretty heavy stuff. Is everything in check now? Do you still have to do certain things to keep yourself healthy?
Yeah, so I was you're declared cancer-free twice, which is a sort of fascinating thing. Right after you finish chemotherapy, they give you a big scan and they see if they can see any cancer. And if they say no, in the case of Hodgkin's lymphoma, they say you're cured. We'll really know if you're cured 5 years later. And so my five-year mark is July 12th, I think, 2016, so this year. So I got 3 months, so cross your fingers out there in Radioland for me. 3 months, and then I'll be 5 years free. There's a song on the new record, Songs from the Lions, a song called Cure. It's in the show as well, and it's a piece that I'm really proud of. There's going to be a new music video for that, too.
Save that for the end. I'd love you to go out on another tune. Let's talk a little bit more about the show itself, if we may. So Between Two Spaces, a book to help raise awareness and funds for the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. You alluded to earlier about the multiple guitars that you're using, one of which you said is an understudy. Nice. Now, are these other guitars characters in the play and in your show, or do they just lend a different sound to the tune that you wrote in a particular way?
Of the seven guitars on stage in Lion, all of them are tuned differently. So they're tuned to different chords.
Joni Mitchell action happened to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so. And so the song Cookie Tin Banjo, The Lion, and Dear Dad, that guitar is tuned CGD-GCE. CGD-GCE. So it gets this big, lovely, open sound. And that guitar is a Froggy Bottom, the guitar that's tuned that way. Froggy Bottom is based in Vermont. I build about 65 guitars a year, and they're extraordinarily beautiful guitars. I've got a second Froggy Bottom, which is the one I just played Weather the Storm on, and that was given to me as a 30th birthday present from my two brothers. And so I played these two Froggy Bottom guitars, and there's a Gibson Les Paul, 1972 Les Paul Gold Top Deluxe. It plays the role of the rock and roll teenage years in The Lion. And then there's a tiny little Martin. It's a half-size Martin guitar, a Martin 5. 18 from 1957, and that plays the role of the little guitar that Dad gave me when I was a kid. There's a guitar that plays the role of Dad's old guitar, and the guitar on stage that I play.
And that one's in tune as well, or out of tune?
Dad's old guitar is in. It's actually the only guitar that starts the show in standard tuning. Dad's old guitar, and it's a 1929 Martin. O18, 87 years old. She's a beauty. And actually, Martin, this is great. Martin very kindly tweeted out, hey, everybody, the Lion is playing in San Francisco. So I don't know if you guys know, but the Martin Guitars started in 1833, the oldest and biggest guitar company in the world. And Martin included a photograph of me playing my Froggy Bottom guitar, not playing one of my many Martins. So I thought, all right, well, okay, guys, but you know, you could have given a photo of me playing your instruments, but I love my Froggies.
That's great. Now, the Lion serves as an apt metaphor for a lot of aspects of the show, exploring both the various meanings of the word pride and roar. So tell us how you're interpreting pride, and you're interpreting pride not only in terms of yourself, but in terms of your family.
Yeah, so the show asks the question, what makes a lion a lion? And the answer at the end of the show is it's not the roar that makes the lion, it's the pride. And the lovely pun that was sort of handed to me is that a family of lions is in fact called a pride of lions, just like there's a murder of crows or a congress of owls. Yeah, so it's a pride of lions. And so, in my character thinks that that which makes a lion is a roar, strength and volume. But I learn eventually that I don't have strength and I don't have volume, which I didn't have when I was sick. And I needed to recalibrate who I was and what made me who I was. And it really was my family. And so that's where what makes a lion. It's not the roar that makes the lion, it's the pride.
Benjamin Shore, The Lion at ACT Strand on Market Street through May 1st. Would you treat us to one more tune as we go out?
Yeah.
tune up this Froggy Bottom. Here we go. One of the reasons I have all these guitars on stage is so I don't have to tune mid-show.
Well, not only music of Ben Scheuer, but of tuning, right?
Ooh-wee. My father has an old guitar, and he plays me folk songs. My father has an old guitar, and he plays me folk songs. There is nothing I want more than to play like him. He goes to the basement and builds me a cookie tin banjo. He builds me a cookie tin banjo. The strings are made of rubber bands. The strap is an old red necktie. The body is the big round lid of a metal cookie tin. When he plays his old guitar, I play my cookie tin banjo. Play my cookie tin banjo right along with him. The more we play together, the more I fall in love with music. And I realize that my banjo is a toy that I've outgrown. I want strings of steel and something new and something real. And so he gets me a guitar to call my own. Then Dad says to me on this fine afternoon, let's sit on the stairs, I'll teach you to tune. He hands me a pick, one that's little and black. He shows me the G chord. I've never looked back. Now buried somewhere in a closet is my cookie tin banjo. In my arms is my guitar, my greatest source of joy. For the life that I have now, I'm grateful to my father, who gave the gift of music to his boy. Started with a simple homemade toy.
Beautiful tune. Benjamin Scheuer, thelionmusical.com for more wonderful links to some very creative videos as well. The Lion runs through May 1st at the Strand Theater. Visit thelionmusical.com. Thanks so much for taking some time, man.
Thanks for having me on the program, Dave. It's a pleasure.
Pablo Eras Casado returns to lead the San Francisco Symphony in 2 weeks of concerts through the end of this month at Davies Symphony Hall, featuring next week the world premiere of the San Francisco commissioned Auditorium by Mason Bates, with the composer performing with the orchestra on electronica. After this past Tuesday afternoon's rehearsal, I caught up with the maestro backstage.
Maestro Eras Casado, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
And thank you for inviting me to your dressing room.
Of course. This is open for anyone who is interested in this wonderful program.
Well, congratulations for your recent rave reviews for your debut with the Philadelphia Orchestra. What took you so long to be involved with that orchestra?
Well, my actual debut was supposed to be 2 years ago. As you know, the schedules always are planned far in advance. So 2 years ago, I planned this for 4 years ago, but I unfortunately had to cancel in the very last minute. I had it's one of the two or three times in my life I've had to cancel, but this happened, so I had to wait another 2 years to reschedule this. But you know, sometimes it's when these things happen, it's because of some, you know, some reason, and you know, it has to be in the right moment. This was the right moment. It was a fantastic week with them, with this wonderful orchestra.
This first week of concerts here in San Francisco includes mostly earlier music, including Jean-Philippe Rameau, which is getting its first San Francisco Symphony performances, his suite from Pygmalion. Now, we should be clear here that this is not the Pygmalion that ended up being My Fair Lady.
That is not at all the same thing. But as you were saying, this is these two we start involving a lot early music, but not only early music, but the way that early music and old music relates to new music and the opposite. In this case, Rameau, I'm presenting a suite of Rameau. A suite is it's coming from a opera dance that was the form at that time. But Rameau is a very modern composer. He's using the old forms to create a new orchestral sound. He's one of the first composers thinking on an orchestral way in the modern sense. So this kind of relation and this kind of different and particular color is what interests me in this composer, as well as other composers, like later in the second week when they are looking back to the classic models, the old models like Shostakovich when composing his Ninth Symphony. It's very much looking backwards to Haydn and to the Classicism, as well as Ravel looking back to the French Baroque as well with the Tombeau de Couperin. So this dialogue back and forth from the new to the old and old with the new is what is very interesting alongside this program.
Beethoven's Second Symphony on the program, and it was just wonderful to hear you rehearse some of the Biber Battaglia, which includes some rather forward-sounding movements and multiple tunes being played simultaneously in one movement, depicting battle with pizzicato and different effects. It had to be fairly revolutionary.
Exactly. So Biber, we are talking, it's a very early composer. We're talking about 17th century. Not the Baroque is not even the late Baroque that we are more used to of Handel and Bach. This is very early Baroque, and he was someone very modern for his time. He's more close to the spirit of Monteverdi and these new composers experimenting with these new possibilities, especially the new technical possibilities of the instruments. The violins and the string instruments were developing at that time, and he's exploring this the left hand pizzicato and col legno and some, you know, a very big scope of sound. And as you were saying, there's one movement who sounds really like atonal music, like modern music. But and the sense of the theatrality, you say theatrality?
Theatricality,
exactly. It's very strong in this piece and very, very modern as well.
Haydn Piano Concerto, which it's posited that it's possibly his the last concerto that he wrote, mm-hmm. which you're doing with Ingrid Fleiter, who you've worked with for several years in different venues.
Yes, and this is a piece that the interesting is that mostly the piano concertos of that classical era are mostly Mozart's concertos, but Haydn piano concertos are not so often performed. And this kind of master composer, this titan of the classicism, it's beautiful, it's wonderful to see his side on how he treats the piano, this instrument in the concerto form, which in a way is... feels when you are more used to Mozart. Of course, Mozart is the master of this form. Haydn is very much experimenting with the structure and many times feels an improvisatory way of playing. And this is very original. And I like to have in the same program Haydn and this early Beethoven, who is already opening the new let's say paths of the revolutionary that he was later.
Working with Ingrid Fleiter, have you done this particular concerto with her before?
No, never. In fact, this is the first time I'm doing this concerto, and she wanted to do it, and of course I was very happy to do it with her. And she's an exquisite musician, and we did before Saint-Saëns and some Bach, but never the classicism. And you know, she's the perfect kind of musician for this music. Mm-hmm.
Well, next week you're going to be doing the San Francisco Commissioned Auditorium by Mason Bates in a program that you also mentioned includes Bartok, Shostakovich's amazing Symphony No. 9. I'm a piccolo player, so I know that piece quite well, and Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin. Mason's auditorium uses the premise of older Baroque music as its inspiration, though they're actually neo-Baroque and original compositions by him, imagined and then electronically imagined. Did you program the Ravel, I'm wondering, who also reaches back to Baroque composer Couperin with that in mind?
Mm-hmm. Of course. I mean, the theme, every time I came here having 2 weeks, I tried to make a mini cycle, a mini festival. The 2 weeks that relate to each other have a theme. And in this case, we were talking already about this theme. And when programming everything, before I had my first conversation with Mason, he also mentioned he had this idea that so... And we had this conversation before he developed more his piece, so it fitted wonderfully and perfectly to this program. So it's I think the chance of having a world premiere as the always a world premiere is a big event, and having a world premiere to finish these 2 weeks, starting from Beaver, from this early Baroque, it's a wonderful chance to discover or rediscover this great scope of repertoire that this orchestra can give.
Have you had an opportunity to program some of Mason's works in your other groups?
No, not at all. I first met Mason when he was composing in residence in Chicago with Chicago Symphony, and when I conducted one of the new music series of the Chicago Symphony, I think it's called Music Now, probably. He was in the program, in the same program I conducted, but his piece was a chamber music piece, so I never conducted myself, but I met his music for the first time there, and since then we wanted to work together.
Well, nice. Well, I'll be talking with Mason for next week's program, so I'll go into more detail about Auditorium by Mason Bates next week on Open Air. Tell us a little bit about your work as a global ambassador of Ayuda en Acción.
Well, this is a very important. I consider myself very lucky to have this chance or for helping other people through music to make their lives a little bit better. Ayuda en Acción is one of the most important non-profit organizations, and it's mainly in Spain. And it's mainly focused on children and helping children from Spain, but also from all Latin America. And they thought, and of course I support them and strongly as much as I can, that they need not only the basic elements like food and clothes and basic education, but also when these kids living in an environment or with families that don't have the best means or are suffering for poverty, so the emotional attention and the emotional education through music and can give them a lot of support, emotional support, discipline. They feel that they are working together to achieve something through discipline, through emotion, through respect, listening to each other, and being, in the end, recognized and being, they are finally the protagonists of that. And so to value those qualities and of those kids, and that for a few moments they can just think of making music together, it's something very, very important. And I'm helping them as much as I can. I'm organizing every year a concert, a charity concert in the Teatro Real, in the Opera House in Madrid, with the Madrid Symphony. And it's a very important part of my life now.
It's terrific that you're carving out that time for such a really worthy cause. Fantastic. Your next gig, so to speak, is you're back in New York on May 5th for the 125th anniversary of Carnegie Hall, a gala concert, which will include a star-studded array, including Martina Arroyo, Emmanuel Ax, Michael Feinstein, Renee Fleming, Marilyn Horne, Yo-Yo Ma, Itzhak Perlman, James Taylor, as well as the Oratorio Society of New York and the Orchestra of St. Luke's, for which you've been principal conductor since the 2012-13 season. That must be quite an exciting event for you coming up.
It is very, very exciting. New York is home for me, a musical home. I've been there for spending more time than anywhere else in the world for a few years now. And with my orchestra, Carnegie Hall is our home where we play our concerts. So to have this chance to be there in this historical moment and having all those friends together on stage, it's a wonderful opportunity. I feel very lucky to be part of that celebration, and it's I'm sure it's going to be great fun to share the stage with all those great artists and friends.
And it's almost 125 years to the day Carnegie Hall was open, so that's quite exciting. Then you're off to Europe for a couple of months of engagements, back to St. Luke's for the Summer Caramore Festival in Katona, New York, which, if folks don't know, is just north of that southwestern corner of the Connecticut Panhandle. This fall, coming to L.A., and then back to our stage in October, works that will include Dvorak's Seventh Symphony, which you just did with the Dutch Radio Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yes, I'm thrilled at this time. I'm coming every year, and I feel so lucky that I'm, since 6 years, I think now, I'm coming every season to San Francisco. But this time I don't have to wait even 1 year. It will be in October, so it's only half a year to be back here. And this time, I have to say, I'm also very happy to come back with a, let's say, pretty traditional program, because normally we are exploring lots of different styles and different musics and having San Francisco premieres. But at this time, so coming and having spending time with the orchestra with Dvorak 7, that for me is one of the most wonderful symphonies of the repertoire. I'm thrilled. I've been doing the symphony this season a few times, also London Symphony and Newell Symphony, Mariinsky. So every time I come to San Francisco, it's for me a new chance to rediscover the repertoire. So this time will be with Dvorak 7, and also, if I'm not wrong, I'm not sure which concerto we're playing with Alisa Wallerstein. I think it's probably Schumann. Yes, Schumann cello concerto with Alisa, who has been and is one of my main musical partners. And so I'm very much looking forward to this.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing not only these concerts, but seeing you again this coming October. Best wishes for the rest of these performances, and we look forward to talking with you. Remaining performances this week are Friday at 7:30 and Saturday at 8, sfsymphony.org for more information. Maestro Pablo Eras Casado, thank you so much for taking some time today.
Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Let's hear some of that Battaglia music of Heinrich Ignaz Franz Bieber. You'll hear some of that extraordinary multiphonic writing after a brief introduction. Amazing writing from 1673. Music of Bieber there. Beethoven, Rameau, and Haydn as well tomorrow and Saturday with guest conductor Pablo Eras Casado. I'll talk with Mason Bates next week about his San Francisco commission piece Auditorium, the featured work next week as Eras Casado concludes his time with the San Francisco Symphony. Again, concert information at sfsymphony.org. I'm thrilled to be a part of the San Francisco Choral Society's concerts this Saturday at 8 and Sunday at 4 at First Unitarian Church on Franklin at Geary here in San Francisco. I'll be narrator for Arthur Onager's King David, a symphonic psalm in three parts after a drama by René Morax. Originally in French, it will be sung and narrated in English, I'm glad to say, and tells the biblical story of the life of David, his advancement to the throne after Saul, his dalliance with Bathsheba, and his eventual death. We rehearsed on Tuesday evening. That's when I had a chance to talk with conductor Robert Geary.
Bob Geary, always a pleasure to welcome you back to Open Air.
Oh, it's nice to be here again. Thanks for having me.
And twofold thanks to start things off. Thank you for once again bringing an amazing piece of music to life, and one not heard often at all. And thank you, of course, for including me as narrator for this.
Oh, yeah, well, we're looking for a great voice, and you have one. So, and I have to say, you're bringing something really creative to it in the way you're working on it, too. So thank you for that.
Well, you're very kind. This is a work that brought early fame to Arthur Onager in the 1920s. He composed, I didn't realize, he did the music for Abel Gance's epic 1927 film Napoleon, and some 9 ballets, 5 symphonies, and this dramatic work, sort of oratorio-like, more of a choral drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of unique, but it reminds you a little bit of Persephone and some of the other works, Stravinsky's Persephone, but some of the other works that were being written around that time that were a little bit mixed media. They had dramatic narration, they may have had dance and other elements, so it wasn't just a choral oratorio with an orchestra and choir. And in this case, we've got, you know, the Witch of Endor roaming about, calling out her incantations, and you're narrating in several different characters and all of that. So,
when did you first come across Onager's King David?
I think it was a couple of years ago, and I actually heard this performance done by New England Conservatory with the original orchestration, which is just winds and brass and percussion, no strings. Now, in our case, we are bringing in a cello and a string bass, which help out a little bit, but no violins and violas. And it's a little bit dated, maybe, because you hear some of the references to sort of modality and a sense of almost like a movie score idea of what the Middle East might sound like, you know. I mean, it might remind you of an epic biblical movie or something like that when you hear the score.
Well, I certainly hear a little bit of Salome going on there.
Yeah, well, for sure, Salome. And, you know, he was studying jazz at the time also, so you hear a few riffs and ideas. It reminds you occasionally a little bit of Gershwin or something like that, too. So anyway, a couple of years ago, I heard it, and it just seemed like an interesting fit. The Choral Society has been doing some more adventurous things. We deal with the masterworks most of the time, but we're taking on the occasional work that, you know, stretches us and brings something different to the community.
Well, we're hearing that sound of the 1920s, and in particular, Onager as a member of Les Six, which was a group of musicians, composers in France, Germain Taillefer, Darius Milhaud, Francis Poulenc, Georges Auric, and Louis Duret, as well as Arthur Onager. But they were more rebelling against the German romantic sound, and yet we hear in this work, you know, I think Onager's coming back to that sound and not necessarily rejecting it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they seem to have a very loose association. You can't find a clear definition of what the aesthetics of Les Six were. It was definitely anti-German, and I hear the word modernist used quite a bit. Remember, at this time, I think the serialism was beginning, so it may also have been, you know, choosing not to go in that direction, which was a much more strict and less expressive modality, at least from some point of view. I mean, some composers stretched it out a little bit more. So I think that they were trying to say we don't have to be part of the German school or something like that, and seemed to have respect for each other. And he was also, as I think you might have just said it, he was Swiss-born, so he wasn't one of the Frenchmen. So it sounds like they were just good friends and kind of all part of that really vibrant aesthetic, creative thing that was going on in Paris there for 15 or 20 years. You know, there were just artists and musicians and composers and dancers and choreographers and, you know, all working together. It was such a wonderful time.
Yeah, I know that they even themselves, amongst themselves, they never wanted to, even for, but for a brief time, have referred to themselves as any sort of a collective because they were working so independently.
Yeah, that seems to be the idea, right? To kind of respect each other's creativity and not get caught up in a movement or something like that. Yeah.
More than once you've referred to in tonight's rehearsal as a three-ring circus. It's quite a work to pull together.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about when we do the great Baroque works or something like that, basically, you have lots to work on, so I'm not suggesting it's a simple thing, but in some ways, you just basically have to set the right tempo and say, okay, everybody, do your thing. And this piece, we've got all kinds of changes of orchestration, changes of tempo, dramatic recitation integrated into arias, integrated into choruses. So it's very colorful, kind of swirl, eclectic is a good word for it, I think.
And again, the orchestration is very challenging. As a flutist, I'm just in awe of the two flutists that were chosen for this work. Amazing oboe work, brass as well.
Yeah. Yeah, bassoon, French horn has a lot to do. And they're all playing as soloists. You know, it's really not as an orchestra with sections or something like that. There's one or two on each part, wind instruments and brass instruments, and they all have lots of solo lines.
Arthur Onager's King David is being presented by the San Francisco Choral Society on Saturday at 8 p.m., Sunday at 4 p.m. Yours truly, David LaTulipe, as narrator. Soloists include Emily Sinclair, Ray Myers, as well as Wendy Hillhouse in the role of the Witch of Endor, all conducted by Bob Geary. We do have four pairs of complimentary tickets for either Saturday or Sunday's performance for listeners who call us now, 415-841-4134 for Saturday's or Sunday's performance of the really remarkable Arthur Onager's King David at the First Unitarian Universalist Church. Call now. Operators are standing by, 415-841-4134. Bob, I'm so looking forward to these performances, as I know you are, and let's keep this collaboration going.
Yeah, well, maybe Persephone is next. Thank you, David.
San Francisco International Film Festival gets underway this evening at 7 at the Castro Theater with writer-director Whit Stillman's comedy Love and Friendship, starring Kate Beckinsale as a sassy social climber set in the 1790s. We heard a brief overview of the festival from Director of Programming Rachel Rosen recently on Open Air, archived, by the way, at klw.org. The festival features some 173 screenings between now and the close of the festival on May 5th. The day we're going to jump to now for a discussion of the closing film. The festival takes a local turn with director Jesse Moss and his documentary, The Bandit. Jesse was the winner of the 2014 Festival Golden Gate Award for Best Documentary Feature for his film, The Overnighters. He's on the faculty of the Cinema Department at San Francisco State University and is a creative advisor at the Sundance Documentary Edit and Story Lab. Jesse, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
Well, remember the 70s? You don't have to answer that. Well, for good or ill, it was a time of big collars, men with shirts unbuttoned down to just above the navel, tinted glasses, all of which you'll get a good sampling of in The Bandit, which documents the remarkable, completely platonic bromance between actor Burt Reynolds and his stunt double-turned-director Hal Needham, who made his non-stunting breakthrough directing Reynolds in Smokey and the Bandit. Jesse, congrats on being selected to close the festival with the Bandit.
Thank you. It's very exciting to bring our film home. We made the film here. Our office is in San Francisco, and it's a great festival. So we're super excited to show it to Bay Area film goers closing night.
Well, how did you get these two guys on your radar to explore, let alone create a full documentary about?
Well, I'm a child of the 1970s. I knew Burt Reynolds through some of his film work, and of course later in life through Boogie Nights. And I wasn't old enough to appreciate Burt in his full glory in the 1970s. I was a pretty young kid, but I knew him for his for being the Bandit. Of course, Smokey and the Bandit was a touchstone film for many people. And still endures improbably. I mean, it's a B movie, maybe a Z movie, but it's one of these films that stood the test of time. And so I was discussing the film with the financier, which is Country Music Television, and we were talking about, was there a film to be made, a documentary that would explore the legacy of this a moonshine picture. That's what it is. It's a moonshine picture. And you know, it seemed to me that I could never really answer the question of why this film endures. You can never really account for that, can you? But rather, there was another film to be made, a story of Burt Reynolds and his relationship to Hal Needham, which wasn't a story that I knew. I mean, I knew a little bit about Burt's life.
So it started out as an exploration of Smokey the Bandit.
I think we quickly realized that was really just the framework for the story, the prism, if you will, to examine Burt's life and career and really extraordinary relationship to his kind of his alter ego, Hal Needham. And I didn't know anything about Hal Needham. He was really a discovery for me in making this film.
And I learned a lot from the film and then doing a little bit of background on him too. Quite a guy.
So I realized that the film was really a buddy movie about a buddy movie, that it was about Burt and Hal and their relationship and how it yielded this extraordinary film that was, I think, second to Star Wars, the biggest moneymaker of 77. So
that's amazing.
That's how we approached telling the story. And, of course, we didn't really know, as you don't know with any documentary, what this story will be because we didn't script it in advance.
So it's really a dual documentary when it comes down to it.
I think, you know, there are actually three things going on in the film. And that's why it took a long time to figure out how to tell the story in the edit room. And as you know, documentaries are really written in the edit room. But it was the story of Burt, the story of Hal, the story of the making of this film. And then really the fourth aspect of the story was their unique connection to each other. And so juggling all of those dimensions was, I think that was for us, the alchemy of making the story work was how to do all of that in a feature-length documentary.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about this remarkable friendship and what made it unique.
Well, you know, I learned a lot about Burt. I didn't, to be honest, know too much about Burt Reynolds. I mean, he's become a kind of tabloid story later in life. But, you know, in the 70s, he was like a comet streaking across the sky. I mean, he was the biggest star in Hollywood for 5 years. And I guess I didn't know where I just assumed he became a star with Deliverance. But when we started the project, we went to Burt, who'd never been the subject of a documentary, and actually not expecting him to get involved. But we visited him at his home in Jupiter. He lives in a gated mansion. And it was a bit like, I don't know, stumbling into the mansion in Sunset Boulevard. I didn't know if I'd make it out alive. But
or the Elvis estate or something.
It was an incredible place, kind of captured in time in a way, preserved in amber. I mean, it felt like a different era. But actually, Burt teaches acting still. He's done that for almost 40 years. And he we filmed him teaching acting. We spent the weekend with him. And he agreed to open up his archives to us to tell this story. I think he was really tickled that here was somebody interested not in his romantic life or personal travails, but really his screen roles and this very important relationship in his life with Hal Needham. So what we discovered was that, you know, he had actually met Hal Needham in the 1950s on Riverboat, way back. Burt had done community theater and then gone to New York and then quickly was discovered as the next Marlon Brando.
Right, right.
which he wasn't going to be.
Yeah.
there can be no other Marlon Brando. But Burt was toiling in television and met this stuntman. And, you know, they brought Hal Needham out and to do a stunt for Burt. And Burt said, no, I can do this stunt. And Hal said, no, you can't. And, well, Burt could. He was actually quite athletic. And this was like the meet cute moment, if you will, of their relationship, and that was the late 50s, and they were really close from that point on for decades.
Well, as you mentioned, we know some of the tabloid features of Burt's life, some of the, even he self admits, scores of bad movies, his relationships and flings with Doris Day and Sally Field. But what we learn about Hal is rather remarkable. I mean, this is a guy who was the highest paid stuntman in the world, broke some 56 bones out of his body, his back twice, punctured a lung, knocked out some teeth, over 4,500 television episodes, 310 feature films. Amazing. And to top it off, when he became a director, which is the crux of the relationship changing, and Burt insisting that Hal become his director instead of just a stuntman, which was a shock to Hollywood, right?
Yeah, well, stuntmen were expected to really live in the shadows and not step out into the limelight. And that was one of the tensions of their relationship, is that I think Hal really was a star in his own right. I mean, he was one of the most famous stuntmen in Hollywood history, and did some extraordinary things and made Burt look fantastic, but really also craved the limelight. And Burt was really more insecure than I think people realize, and was kind of looking for an identity, and found that in Hal Needham, and really, in a way, wanted to be a stuntman. And so you had this kind of interesting convergence where I think Hal wanted to be Burt and Burt wanted to be Hal. And together they could do things that they couldn't do apart. And so I think Burt kind of going out on a limb and letting Hal get a shot, directing him, the biggest movie star in the world, in Smokey and the Bandit, kind of putting his own career on the line, and Hal Needham stepping up to take the reins of a Hollywood movie. He'd never done that before. I mean, that's what they both were risking to make this happen. And it was not a script that people thought was particularly good. In fact, Burt himself said, you know, this is a kind of a piece of crap. But they got it in shape, and they kind of took off. And that's the story we tell in part in the documentary.
Jesse, let's talk about some of the source material for this film. You mentioned you had the cooperation of Burt for some of this. How did you assemble such extensive material, from talk show host interviews to private videos made by movie cast members and crews? You put out an APB somewhere, or an ad in Variety, or what? How does that work for documentarians?
Well, it was two things. One was going to Burt's house, and after the interview with Burt over 2 days, saying, Burt, do you have any photographs? And he said, sure, look in there. Look in the pool house. And we walked in, and it was stacked floor to ceiling with tapes, films, scrapbooks, photographs. I mean, it was like, for a documentarian, it was like discovering an ancient tomb of artifacts. And none of it was, well, the scrapbooks were organized, and those were wonderful. They were scrapbooks that I think his mother had kept in the late 1950s.
Wow.
But then, and you see them in the film, there are these wonderful episodes of the Burt Reynolds Late Show from, I think, 1974. It was short-lived, but really rather remarkable. And, you know, Burt was an incredible talk show guest and host. He guest-hosted The Tonight Show. I mean, he's wonderful on television. And that show in particular, the Burt Reynolds Late Show, has really yielded some choice moments. The other half of the material in the film, I'd say, comes from just digging detective work. Hal Needham, we heard from people, had been the first human being to test the airbag. And we thought, this cannot be true. This has got to be an apocryphal story. But our ace image researcher, Rich Remsburg, found the footage in an Allstate Insurance industrial video.
Wow.
And, you know, so much of this is on 16-millimeter film. I mean, once we had it transferred 4K, it looks amazing. And Hal Needham, I mean, he did the most incredible stunts, not just in the movies, but like he did this truck jump for General Motors. We found this. So we found these individual kind of gems of archival material, and really helped to bring to life Hal Needham. The goal of the film was really to let these two guys, who were just incredible, charismatic stars, speak for themselves and tell the story in their own words. You know, there's no narration. These guys tell the story. And so finding those interviews, those moments where they could tell us about their relationship, about their careers, about their failures, and about the making of this film. That's what the goal was.
Well, that says a lot in this day and age of the internet and YouTube and instant gratification, that there's a lot of detective work and true documentarianism.
And, you know, a lot of this stuff doesn't come off YouTube. I mean, we found something that Hal Needham had done for Pontiac, and because we found the retired president of the Pontiac Dealers Association of America had been keeping this tape cartridge in his basement. So that it was that stuff. You know, I love what the internet can yield in the way of research, but this was like detective work and wonderful stuff.
I love that you included some of the downright clueless interviewers. In particular, early on, there's an interviewer who refers to the film as Smokey and the Bear, and Hal corrects her, and then she doesn't seem to even realize that he directed the film.
You know, Hal really couldn't get respect until he proved himself, and that is a funny. You know, Universal Studios produced the film. And that they had a policy of not keeping – well, first of all, I didn't expect Smokey and the Bandit to do any business. So it wasn't a big production for them. So there was very little on-set documentation. And what they did have, they got rid of because they didn't think there was any value in it. But fortunately, some local news networks in Atlanta where they shot the film did cover the production of the film. So you got some vintage moments on set, casting the dog, doing stunts. I mean, just great stuff that helped us kind of bring those moments to life on set.
The film is The Bandit. It closes the San Francisco International Film Festival on the 5th of May, 7 p.m. screening at the Castro Theater. Burt Reynolds may be there, no guarantees, but I do guarantee that right now we have three pairs of tickets available to callers who call 415-841-4134. The Bandit screening at the Castro, closing the film festival May 5th, 7 p.m., Castro Theater, 415-841-4134. Three pairs of tickets. Full festival information at sffs.org. Director Jesse Moss of The Bandit, thanks so much for sharing some time with us.
Thanks, David.
Going out with music from Smokey and the Bandit.
Are we going to do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just watch old Bandit run. They can't be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just watch old Bandit run. Old Smokey's got them ears on. He's hot on your trail. He ain't gonna rest till you're in jail. So you got to dodge him, you got to duck him. You gotta keep that diesel trucking. Just put that hammer down and give it hell. Eastbound and down, are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time.
With the strains of Jerry Reed's theme to Smokey and the Bandit, it's time to conclude this week's edition of Open Air. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show, which is archived at our website, kalw.org. If you have a suggestion for an arts segment, by all and any means, send me an email to david@kalw.org or drop me a note or flyer here at the station, 500 Mansell Street, 94134. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks so much for spending this hour with me.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we talked to writers from this year's Penn World Voices Festival.
When I talk to educators, I say, you know, Mexican Americans are magic. We can walk right through a U.S. history textbook and poof, just disappear.
You know, our history has become invisible.
That's this week on Latino USA.